Welcome to Mastering Agility. If you want to listen to authentic conversations with the most inspiring guests, find like-minded people in the Mastering Agility Discord community or both online and face-to-face events, this is the platform for you. Grab a drink, sit back, and join professional scrum trainers Sander Doerr, Jim Sammons, and their guests in an all-new episode.
Good evening, good morning, good afternoon, depending on where you're listening from. Today, we've got David Ash. David, how are you doing?
I am well. Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
We're delighted to have you. We're talking about your book, The Agile Enterprise. But before we're going to dive into the actual content, what compelled you to write this book?
Well, interestingly, I was approached by somebody on LinkedIn, which I thought was a hoax. But this guy said, hey, do you want to write a book about Agile? And I said, well, you know, the thing is that my bookshelf is crowded with Agile books, and I don't really have anything new to say about Agile. But what I have been doing in my consulting business is applying concepts from the Agile Manifesto across companies. And if you're interested in my writing about something like that, I think maybe I have a book in me. I'm not sure if I do, but I'll give it a go. And that's sort of what started me on it. And I had started a consulting company before this, 10X Principles. And I'm not a very good marketer. I'm even worse salesperson. But what I started doing is writing and writing blog posts and writing things. And I found that I had a lot in me to get out. And it kind of made me think I could write this book, which I did.
You mentioned you felt like it was a hoax. Why did you think so?
Well, I think we're just so accustomed to being kind of bombarded on LinkedIn by people trying to sell us things that we really don't necessarily want. So when someone kind of approached me like that was just my first reaction. And furthermore, I mean, I think we all tend to feel like, you know, kind of frauds ourselves. And you know, when this guy asked me, I thought, who am I to be writing a book about this? You know, it turns out I have had years and years of experience doing it, and I had a lot to say about it. But at the time, I didn't really think about myself that way. So that's really kind of why I thought, this guy's got to be kidding me. He's got the wrong person.
Is that something like imposter syndrome? I mean, with Jim and with Ryan Brook, for instance, and other people, we talked quite elaborately about how imposter syndrome can, you know, tackle your motivation or tackle the way that you generally come across. How was that for you?
You know, imposter syndrome kind of burns strongly within me. As I was writing, I was thinking, gosh, people who really understand these things are going to call me on it when I've written this. And however, upon reading and rereading and editing and all that, I kind of have gone through and I thought, you know, this isn't so bad, what I've written here. Maybe I'm not a fraud after all. But yeah, I mean, I think for people who kind of have, you know, it's not that I have low ego or high ego or anything. I sort of normal ego. I think it's sort of a normal thing for people to say, oh, well, I'm presenting myself as the expert here. Am I really the expert? And I think that's sort of hopefully normal.
It's natural, I guess. But yeah. I think it complements the quality that you deliver as well. I tend to think if you try to present yourself as the expert on something, that it comes across that way and it puts people off.
It does.
You started writing for the Mastering Agility Medium publication as well. The stuff that you wrote, I think, was excellent.
Well, thank you.
So I enjoyed that. So just a general feedback. Don't feel that there's anything when it comes to the imposter syndrome. I like whatever I wrote, whatever I was reading, as well as the book on the Agile Enterprise. I liked it.
Well, you are free to call me out on anything. And you know, one of the things that I like so much about the writing process is that people do tend to, you know, add to it and say, hey, had you thought about this? Or here's my experience with this. And, you know, we're not islands, really. We need to kind of communicate these things to one another. And it results in kind of better understanding and better better thinking in the end.
Yeah.
And that's really what I was trying to do with this book, is get my thoughts out and kind of get my experiments out. So what I had done in my consulting business is that I started this business after a kind of a long career in engineering management, a really long career in engineering management. And I recognized that kind of there's a dysfunction, a kind of a pathology in so many companies of dysfunction as companies move into a different stage of growth. So if they move from a startup to not a startup anymore, they get some infusion of cash or they've made money. And teams grow and everything gets bigger all of a sudden. The things that used to work in a startup no longer work. And sometimes processes are put in place. Sometimes processes are too heavy. Sometimes they're not. But when that happens, things tend to get dropped on the floor sometimes. So communication that used to happen kind of organically between people across teams no longer happens in the same way. People need to stay in their lanes more. People are kind of more objective driven within their own teams, and sometimes silos get created, things like that. So I had recognized that as a kind of a thing to focus on. And a lot of my customers have allowed me to experiment and apply agile principles, not necessarily just in engineering. And I found a lot of success in that, in kind of taking small bites out of a problem and measuring progress along the way. So
what was the biggest learning point that you encountered yourself while experimenting in these organizations? I mean, I can imagine that it's kind of a sandbox where you have just almost a right to do whatever and see what happens.
Yeah. Well, what I found, and you know, this may not sound like a revelation to you, because it's not really, but it was surprising to me, is that the ideas in the Agile Manifesto were really intended for software developers, but they're so sensible and appropriate that kind of anyone can understand them. And so, for example, I worked with an HR team, and they were tasked with hiring a bunch of people. And kind of rather than making this grandiose 6-month plan for how they were going to get all these people in place at the end of 6 months, we kind of chunked the work up and talked about kind of the process of, well, how do we track people and how do we kind of manage this and how do we manage the communications and how do we measure our success in this? And thinking about these things in a kind of a smaller way. And what it enabled this team to do was to stretch a little bit and realize, okay, if they failed at something along the way, it wasn't the end of the world, because it's not like the end of 6 months and they haven't hired their people. It's some little thing they tried to do along the way, didn't work, and okay, we'll try something different next time. And we didn't really use any of the trappings of any of these agile methodologies or any of that stuff, but we just sort of talked about the ideas around small batch work. And it really applies not just to HR, but to sales and marketing and, you know, all aspects of a company, interestingly enough. And so the kind of the takeaway was how easily people kind of understood that and adapted to it.
Did you see any type of aversion when it comes to like Scrum terminology from compared to developers and HR or sales, or for that matter? Like, people are regularly not necessarily involved in the day-to-day Scrum usage.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you ask about that, because, you know, in a lot of ways, kind of the terminology of Scrum has almost permeated all aspects of companies. You know, everybody seems to know about sprints, and they know about stories, and they know about story points. I mean, nobody really understands exactly what they are, but they kind of use these terms and stand-ups and you know, retrospectives, and you know, all the buzzwords people seem to know, not just in engineering, because I think they're just bandied about so much that they become familiar. But my goal here was not really to implement that sort of environment. The goal was really to kind of get down to the basics of this. And I think in a lot of ways, the methodologies were kind of put in place as a way to help operationalize a philosophy, which is the Agile Manifesto. How do you actually make that real? And so what I just tried to do was to work with the leaders in these groups and figure out a way to operationalize these ideas and to actually sort of figure out what are our short-term goals, what are our long-term goals, and how are we going to meet them, and what's our plan to do that, and you know, how do we want to time box ourselves to get these things done, and how do we want to measure our success or failure? It's important that we recognize failure if we fail, and you know, not cry about it, but kind of move forward and do better next time.
You mentioned you work with the leaders. Like, how do you identify leaders?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. You know, in a lot of ways, some of the companies that I'm involved with, people have just sort of fallen into roles, just because they are the ones who have exhibited the kind of interest in doing something. However, those are not necessarily the leaders in these things. What I've found is that the people who really kind of take initiative to think a little bit differently are the ones who are the leaders. So for example, in this HR thing, one of the people in one of the teams said, well, you know, the thing is about interviews and that stuff. I hate those things because I never can really get the essence of somebody. I just feel like people are always acting, and I feel like often we're hiring the best actors, not the most qualified people necessarily. So how do we do this better? And what she said was, well, let's audition them. And I said, well, you can't really just give people like a take-home assignment, or if you do that, people aren't going to have time to do it. And she said, no, not like that exactly, but you know, have a discussion with them where we maybe collaborate on a piece of work or something that we need to accomplish, and kind of see how they take direction, see how they can give direction, kind of try to get a feel for what it would be actually like to interact with this person on something real. And that kind of formed the basis of what they did to vet candidates and just to see how they would do with the team and with teammates to accomplish something real. And it was, you know, small things, but real things. So that's sort of, you know, how I viewed the leaders in this.
I think that's a good approach, because these days it feels that we're looking for either the loudest one too much, or indeed what you're saying, that like the one who gets the biggest Oscar for being the best actor. Like, you know, it's very easy to talk yourself into a job to perform in that, what is the time span of an hour, to impress the hiring manager of, you know, but then you actually have to walk the walk and then just talk the talk. And then it becomes very stressful to a lot of people that you have to demonstrate the actual skills that you have portrayed, that you possess. And then it becomes tricky to a lot of people.
Yeah, so you don't want to just hire the glib person or the, you know, the person who, you know, is the most verbally agile. You need to find somebody who really enjoys doing the work that you have in mind for them and is competent at it.
Yeah. So, but how do you filter out? Because at the same time, it feels like we're very short-sighted and just looking at either someone's LinkedIn or just their resume. How do you filter out that they're actually able to perform the job that you're asking them to do?
Well, in a lot of ways, this audition process, in many ways, helps to do that. Because if, say, you know, it's an engineer you're hiring, you might collaborate on an engineering problem with them. Talking through maybe something that the team is currently trying to work through. Not necessarily coding, although it could involve code, but also just sort of involving problem solving and how do you think about this thing and how would you do this? So that's an example from an engineering standpoint. But from another standpoint, there's if you're looking for a product manager, part of it is, well, how do you think about this process of product and you know, what is discovery to you? And give me an example of something that has been a success for you. And listening to how people describe their work and then kind of digging in and asking questions about the specifics, I think is really a good way of understanding how people think about these things and also how much fun they'd be to work with on a day-to-day.
Is that important to you, how fun they are?
It is. I mean, it's not that I'm looking necessarily to have them be my best friends or anything like that. But you know, I think for all of us, we spend so much time working. You know, I find nothing better than looking forward to actually interacting with the people that I'm with so many hours in a day. And by fun, that can have a lot of different connotations. I don't mean that they're, you know, out wearing a party hat necessarily, but really it's more a matter of, you know, is this an interesting person to talk to? Do they have good ideas? Is this, you know, someone who's not just going to agree for the sake of agreeing, but really has kind of a unique thought pattern? To me, that's kind of a fun person.
Yeah. Those are two different things, right?
Yeah.
Fun is not defined as what you're saying, for instance, like wearing a fun hat. That's more of a gimmick. Fun is the way that many people like you and me perceive it, is a sense of fulfillment that you get out of a job that, you know, it feeds you energy instead of the other way around, that you pour buckets of energy into it and not really get anything out of it.
Right. Right. Yeah, indeed. So, you know, people who can kind of give and take and are flexible in their thinking. So, I mean, I think kind of what we're getting to is, you know, what is a smart person? And I mean, I think we all find it, you know, if we ourselves consider ourselves smart, it's fun to work with other smart people, I think, who are going to challenge our ideas and come up with better ideas and, you know, all of that. And, you know, kind of what I say to people, in the interview process is, look, you know, if I ask you about conflicts you've had with people, it's not that I'm expecting us to get into a cage match or anything like that. And it's not this viper pit of disagreement. However, I expect us to disagree. And if we don't disagree, there's a problem here. And, you know, as long as we can do it respectfully and professionally, that's great. And the best ideas will come to the surface that way.
Oddly enough, I've been doing martial arts for quite a big chunk of my life, and there is nothing more respectful I've ever seen compared to any other sport than martial arts. Even though cage matches might seem like it's beating the shit out of everyone, there is nothing more respectful than this part of sports. But that's a completely different discussion. I completely agree with you on the other side of the spectrum. You got to be able to disagree with each other, and that's why these kind of hiring policies are so important. That we hire for diversity, and I don't mean in the color of skin or sex in sexual preference in that sense, but more in that I'm not always, as a hiring team or hiring person, hiring myself, basically, right? That we hire diverse skills, diverse cultural backgrounds, diversity of opinions, diversity of skills, so that we are complementary to each other and not always just like-minded, the exact same type of people.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, you know, the other thing is in an interview process, people are really reluctant to disagree, and sometimes culturally it's a cultural taboo to be disagreeing with somebody in that kind of a setting. So, you know, part of it is that you sort of have to go in with a little bit of an understanding of that as well, that people are feel constrained in some ways. And that, you know, once again, the interview process is an artificial thing that doesn't reflect necessarily how somebody will be. So it's, you know, it's important to gather as many data points and have them talk to as many people as possible.
I agree. And at the same page, let's not always take into account every single small detail and opinion of everyone, and, you know, it kind of feels we're drifting away too much from solutioning and try to feel too much of public image just to make sure that we seem that we're doing the right thing, but not actually doing the right thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you can kind of drive yourself crazy, kind of being concerned about fairness in hiring and you know, ensuring that everyone gets the same fair shake and things. And it's not that I'm advocating against that. I'm just saying sometimes, you know, things happen where I discover something about someone that I didn't realize. And I thought, huh, had I realized that in the process, I would have thought differently about what you just said to me and things like that. So,
yeah. No, again, I'm not against disadvantage of any type of person, type of group or whatsoever. But conflict needs to happen sometimes in order to progress.
Yeah.
So that we open our eyes again and say, oh, fuck, you messed up. I didn't think about that kind of viewpoint. That's interesting. Let's dive deeper into that and figure out what's the best way forward. Because that's the way that we actually develop. If we're always on the same page, then we'll always be on the same page and therefore always doing the exact same thing. Mastering agility only works with organizations aligned with our values, and that's exactly why we are excited to work with our sponsor. Scrum Match is the free platform for professionals run by professionals. On Scrum Match, true Scrum Masters get hired by companies serious about their popular framework. The awesome people behind this platform have decades of experience, among them a professional Scrum trainer for Scrum.org. They've interviewed, trained, and coached hundreds of like-minded people, and they use this exact experience to make you stand out from the crowd and help you get in touch with companies looking for true Scrum Masters. So go to scrummatch.com and sprint to your dream job.
Right. And that's the wonderful thing about working with a group of smart people. Like, so, you know, for example, if I take an idea to an engineering team, you know, have them kind of completely beat me up about it and ultimately come up with a much better approach than I had ever imagined. And, you know, going through that whole discussion, you know, often all it takes is for somebody like a product manager to come in with kind of the nugget of an idea and a suggestion for, you know, here's what I'm thinking. This is the problem we need to solve. How about if we do it like this? And they'd say, no, not like that. But I understand what you're asking for, and wouldn't this be a better thing? And, you know, kind of riffing on that and having people kind of having the freedom to come in and express their opinions without recrimination and you know, without casting aspersion on people's ideas and really come to the best solution. And it's not that it has to come from an engineer. It can come from a product manager. It can come from a project manager, you know, whoever. And I've seen ideas take root that didn't originate out of engineering, oddly enough. So.
And usually those kind of opinions and those kind of solutioning modes tend to work very refreshing, right?
It's like, yeah,
this is something that we never thought about. How should we work with that? How should we figure out how we can leverage that in order to put that into our product and think of something completely different? That's how you open up perspectives. If you learn, let's just generalize this thing. And let's assume that I learned Java at some point, which I didn't, but just for the sake of argument, I'm not going to stick to the same Java kind of trick forever until I go out of production myself, until I enter my retirement age. I need to keep up with constant change, especially now with these progressive age with AI and I don't know whatnot. I need to incorporate all those techniques and mechanics and methodologies and ideas into my toolbox in order to progress and to find the best product possible. I cannot just be that one trick pony.
That's right.
Yet on the other hand, we seem to be trusting weight and be relying way too much in the same skills that we've been doing forever. Especially just riffing for that sake on AI, technology is advancing faster than we can keep up with, which is funny because we are the ones creating the technology. So we're kind of outpacing ourselves.
Yeah. I mean, one of the standard kinds of questions now for incoming employees is, well, how can you marshal AI and ChatGPT to kind of accelerate and help you in your own job? And how do you think about that? And I've heard really interesting things from people. You know, I hear a lot of people say, well, I'll always use ChatGPT to kind of lay out a basic set of code for myself. And maybe I'll modify it from there, but it does gives me a pretty good first cut. Or somebody might say, well, if I'm looking to program a spreadsheet, I'll do it this way. And you know, it can be used pretty powerfully. I mean, I'm not conversant enough in it myself to figure out how to make it work for me yet. But I think it's an important part of people's jobs now that they figure out how to use these technologies to help them. And you know, I think it's really a kind of an interesting thing that, you know, in a lot of the kind of the public, people are kind of looking suspiciously at these technologies, like, oh, it's going to take my job, and you know, it's not done by a human. Whereas I think the right answer is we need to figure out how to make it work for us, each of us.
Interesting. Teresa Torres was on this podcast a couple of weeks ago, and she mentioned AI is here to augment us, not to replace us. So it should be like an extension of the work that we do and not to replace us. So we need to figure out how to coexist and not to have us replaced.
That's right. Exactly. How do you flex your work to become a good partner with this stuff?
And I was teaching a PSPO class today together with one of my PSD colleagues, Evelyn Rosen. We were talking about this stuff too, and it's the same with implementing a framework like Scrum. You still need to think for yourself, is this stuff, are there things that we're doing, does this make sense? Does this help us achieve our outcomes, our desired outcomes? And instead of just saying, here's our magic wand, it used to be Scrum, now it's AI, now we're using AI, and therefore we have all the knowledge, we contain all the answers that we need to know. No, that's not true. You still need to figure shit out for yourself.
Yeah.
So don't stop thinking for your
own. Right. And yeah, I mean, I think the kind of the most brain dead stuff is when the trappings of something like Scrum are adopted by a team without really understanding why they're doing it or how it's benefiting them. You know, we're going to have a stand up every day, and we're going to have a retrospective, and we're going to have these sprints, and we're going to have a backlog, and we're going to have velocity, and you know, all these buzzwords that people can kind of toss into it, without really getting to the root of solving a problem in the most effective way, and kind of doing discovery on that problem up front, so that when people are actually working, they know what they're supposed to be working on. So. Yeah.
Then how do we need to intertwine these two? Because one of the things that you're an avid writer about is firefighting, and still we seem to be firefighting a lot in our organizations these days.
Yeah, I mean, fires are one of these kind of constants. And I think, you know, as long as we have systems that are built by humans for other humans, there's always going to be things that kind of don't work the way people expect them to work. And you know, I guess the cause of a fire is when a customer is dealing with something that isn't behaving in the way that they need it to behave. And, you know, an extreme case of this is something that prevents their business from actually moving forward, some problem in a product. And, you know, it's that kind of thing that kind of gets in the way of progress. And you know, the thing is that you know, the nature of a fire is that it's an unexpected thing. You know, some organizations it's a regular thing, so maybe exactly. You should expect
to
it more.
Some people they might be expected.
But it's sort of like, often once a fire is over, everybody is so exhausted by it that they want to kind of forget it ever happened and go back to life as normal again. and the problem with that is that if you don't sort of spend time after a fire to kind of do a post-mortem and figure out, well, what was the cause of that thing really? And what did it expose in our product that requires us to make change? You know, you're likely to just face the same kind of fire again. And that's like the worst. You know, it's one thing to be fighting a different kind of fire each time. That's cooler than fighting the same fire each time. And
some people thrive on this kind of chaos. I mean, this is a personal story, but one of my family members married an arsonist at some point, and that person really wasn't aware that it was an arsonist. And for some magic reason, trucks would get set on fire wherever this person would appear. And it took about 30 trucks to go up in flames before they start to figure out this pattern.
Wow. Yeah, yes. No one expects to be married to an arsonist. It's not kind of thing. Yeah, no one advertises that.
No, that and usually it's a mental thing because these people thrive on chaos, but also they can show up to pretend to be the hero. Like, I put out this fire. I know how to deal with this. Look at me being so awesome.
Yeah.
But hold on. If you scratch the surface, you're the one who created this.
Yeah, yeah. So I don't want to denigrate firefighters, but you know, there is that statistics that a large number of them are, you know, love to look at fires and you know, that's the thrill of firefighting for many people, is this idea of being the hero and putting it out. And similarly, there's a lot of corporate culture, you know, it's often startup culture that really values this idea of everyone wearing many hats and banding together and extinguishing fires. And, you know, in a lot of ways, it's not that employees intentionally set these fires. However, a lot of employees are, you know, really derive a lot of satisfaction from putting them out. And so it leads one to believe that perhaps people aren't trying hard enough to prevent the causes of fires in the first place.
So. No, agreed. And also, just to make sure that I'm conveying myself as good as possible, there's a difference between a firefighter and an arsonist. And you have both in the organization where people thrive on this chaos and making sure that they create stuff that then they can put out apparently themselves so they can appear as the hero. Like, I solved this impediment. Well, kudos to you, but you also created this yourself. So you know, you're kind of shaking your own hand. And then there's the actual firefighter who figures out a solution to make sure to prevent that. You know, the old American paradigm, only you can prevent forest fires, that kind of applies in organizations as well.
Right.
You are the one who can prevent these kind of impediments from occurring if you just make sure that either you smother them the moment that you see them, or you don't start them at all.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, what I've typically seen, you know, when you think about the causes of fire, so, you know, and this is kind of a fire analogy. We're going deep into the fire analogy, but, you know, you need oxygen for a fire. And, you know, the oxygen could really be just things like human error and things like that cause the thing, and you need some sort of fuel which would burn, and you know, those combine, and you need some source of heat. So, you know, a customer kind of flexing things in a way that you hadn't anticipated can kind of cause these fires. And the question is, how does a company respond to these things, and how do they kind of contain them in a way? You know, it's one thing if you're a small company and you have one customer who has a fire, and, you know, if that customer is down unless the fire is extinguished, then okay, then everybody can join in and put the thing out. But it doesn't work when there's a lot of customers, or when you have deadlines, or if you're actually trying to deliver products. Having everybody in a company kind of jump into a fire and work to extinguish it just doesn't work. You know, for just about any company, there's almost no circumstance that an all hands on deck kind of fire response is an appropriate response. And often the culture of a company rewards this firefighting so much that it's hard for people to kind of change. You know, how do you become a non-arsonist?
No, agree. But at the same time, it seems to be a self-fulfilling prophecy where organizations spend too little time on delivering actual quality over making sure that we have set a proper definition of done, making sure that we understand when can we go to production, when do we meet done criteria, making sure that the stuff that we deliver is of sufficient standard in order to prevent rework from occurring. But we just got to push to production because A, we promise it, or even worse, sales promise it to our stakeholders, and we just got to go to production right away, yet preferably yesterday, skip testing and let's go.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, absolutely. We live in an imperfect world, and there are pressures beyond just sort of a perfect technical solution that demand that things get delivered sometimes that are not optimal. And I think the kind of the art is figuring out, well, what corners can you cut that aren't going to cause a fire? And how do you repair some of the things that you've done along the way that could result in a fire? And how do you do that? And you know, I think a kind of a team of craftspeople, you know, will really be insistent that they deliver a quality product and not deliver until that thing is ready. And then there's another side of the company that says, but if we don't deliver this thing, you know, in this amount of time, we're losing this much revenue and we can't exist as a company unless we move forward with that. So, you know, somehow you kind of have to split the difference and figure out, well, what can we afford to do and what, you know, what features can we afford not to have? And, you know, in a lot of ways, being less feature rich and having high quality, smaller features is preferable to kind of a broad swath of functionality, none of which works very well. So, you know, some of it is this quality over quantity thing also.
Do you think we should set a price or quantify the results of organizational arson?
Well, yeah. I mean, the thing is that you know, it's hugely expensive, and it you know, in most cases, it's depending on how the management in the company works. Often, fires are just sort of forgotten after they're done, and nobody is really trying to quantify it. And they can be hugely expensive, not just the fighting of the fire, but whatever has to be done after the fire to actually address the issue so the fire doesn't flare up again. And, you know, I think having kind of a gimlet-eyed approach to fires and understanding the costs of them is really important. Not just the cost of the fire itself. Okay, it was this 2 days of productivity times X many people. That's the easy part of it. The hard part of it is, well, what if kind of this technical debt that needs to be fixed as a result of this fire requires a re-architecture of this part of the product? What is that going to cost us? How long is that going to take? How does that derail our roadmap? What does that mean for us? And, you know, these are the kinds of the things that okay, well, then maybe we shouldn't have taken that shortcut before. Maybe the next time we need to think about things a little bit differently and not release our software so quickly so we don't have to make those kinds of compromises. But, you know, often the causes of fires, I think, are kind of in the real legacy parts of a product that you know, have had developer after developer after developer kind of working on this complicated piece of product for a long time, and nobody has had the courage to kind of rip it apart and rebuild it, or the company has not wanted to swallow the expense of doing that. But sometimes when you ask about kind of quantifying this, that's exactly what, you know, the cold calculus of the you know, of the rework, I think is the real hidden cost of all this fire stuff.
So what did you do in the consultancy gigs that you work with? What did you do to break that chain of developer over developer over developer and so on?
Well, the, you know, it's a hard chain to break. I mean, part of it is really helping to prevent things get to that level. And you know, it's not developers and engineers who are opposed to fixing technical debt. They're anxious to do that. It's kind of often the business that says, well, we don't get anything out of that. We want these new features and we want this new stuff, this new shiny stuff. And, you know, you can get to this other thing that you're yammering about later. And when that happens for too much time, that's when these problems start to happen. New developers come in and they have to kind of work on this stuff and it becomes a bigger problem. So what I've found is that advocating for kind of keeping a clean shop is really one of the solutions to this problem is to not let things get so far that they just become out of control in terms of the cost of fixing something or the cost of redoing something.
But how do you quantify that? Like, what is the moment that you've made that apparent? Like, right now, we're derailing to such an extent that we need to jump on this right fucking now.
I think the end of a fire is the opportune time to make a pronouncement like that, just because you can say at that point, well, look, if we don't address this now, look what this has cost us. This is going to keep happening. It might happen a little bit differently, but here's why it's going to keep happening, because we haven't done this and we haven't done that and we haven't done this. So this gives us the following vulnerabilities, any one of which could kind of kill us again. And, you know, part of it is nobody really wants to, a CEO doesn't want to be told, hey, we need to completely re-architect this product. And it's going to be, you know, it's going to be a year of heads down development work. And in the end, you're going to get a less featured product in the end. So, you know, that's a kind of a mercenary sort of thing for an engineering team to do. So it's really better to make a plan, an iterative plan to solve this thing. Not that everybody has to work heads down on this thing forever, but, you know, we need to make steps to improve on this. And until we finish this, we're still at some risk. But as we chip away at the problem, kind of like an agile approach to things, as we chip away at the problem, our risks decrease as we go. And eventually we're kind of out of that hole. And the question of how much and how fast and how much we want to do, I think is a discussion for the technical side of the company and the business side of the company to have. You know, just how quickly does this need to happen? How much of a risk is it for us? How much will it cost us if this happens again? Will we lose customers because of this? You know, questions like that. And I think in some ways that helps the two sides of the companies come together and agree. And it's not just engineering yelling about, hey, we need to do this because we took a shortcut and we don't like that and we think it would be better this way. But really, like you're saying, of quantifying it and saying, hey, this is what it is going to cost us. And these are the real risks of this thing. And here's what happens if we don't do it. And, you know, you can decide if you think customers would leave because of it. And if you think that, how expensive are they to replace? And everybody knows it's really expensive to replace customers. It's much easier to keep them.
Yeah. So summarizing that question, and I'm in luck that Jim, the star co-host, is not here, because he would charge me for this answer. But it depends. So it really depends, again, and a lot of factors.
Yeah, sure, it does. It does. I mean, there's no real answer to what you do about a fire. I mean, I think containing a fire makes sense to just about anyone. That you know, you figure out who needs to be involved in something and communicate pretty clearly to people who don't need to be involved in a fire. Hey, keep going. Ignore this as much as you can. Keep moving forward on your own track. You know, if we need you, we know you're there, and we appreciate that. But don't get distracted by this thing. And you know, that's the first part of it. But then the real hairy part of it is after the fire. How do you recover, and what do you do? So, and you're right. There is no answer that there's no one size fits all kind of answer to this.
No. Agreed. I've got two more questions remaining, because then we slowly need to start wrapping up.
Please.
One is, where can people find you? Where can people find your book?
Well, my book is sold on Amazon, and you can find me in LinkedIn. And my book is also sold in Business Expert Press, they're the publisher of the book. But I think most people can look up Ash Agile or something like that in on Amazon, and the book will come up.
All right. So to summarize, the book is called The Agile Enterprise, written by David Ash. Last question, and I'm going to, after that, I'll start wrapping up and make sure that you have a proper weekend. But if there's a question that you would recommend us to ask our next guest, or you would like us to ask our next guest without knowing who it is, what would you like us to ask that person?
Let's see. I would want to know what comes after Agile, from a development perspective. What's the next thing, and how do we incorporate all these new technologies like AI that are on the horizon? And what does that mean for business in the future and engineering in the future?
All right. I'm looking forward to asking this question. I'll make sure to do so.
Please do.
David, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for handing me.
I enjoyed reading the book. Appreciate it. I know how much of an effort it is to actually write a book and to keep going and to ensure the pace that still make sure that you do actually deliver the book, its whole process. So all kudos to you. Thank you again for being here, asking all these questions.
Thank you for having me. It's really delightful conversation. So you're really good at this. So thank you.
Appreciate that. Thank you very much, Herb. Talk to you soon.
Thank you. Bye.
That is all for today. Thank you for listening. If you liked this episode, let us know by hitting that like button, share it with friends and colleagues, sharing a message on LinkedIn, joining our warm and welcoming Discord community, or attend recordings as a virtual audience. You can find all the relevant links in the show notes. We hope you'll tune back in for the next episode of the Mastering Agility Podcast.